This spacecraft, around which America's hopes of reaching the moon in this decade are centered, the man-machine mix it's called. How long can Apollo fly? How long will its oxygen, fuel cells, and control fuel hold out? They have to last 10 days before astronauts can safely attempt landings on the moon or flights around the moon.
NASA logbook entry, October 1962. Formed to market 528, the highway leading to the manned spacecraft center in Houston, is renamed NASA One, as NASA welcomes a new group of astronauts and their families to the home of the space program.
My name is Valerie Anders, and I'm married to Bill Anders, who was an Apollo 8 astronaut. We joined the third group, called the Apollo Astronauts. He went to Houston from Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he'd been an Air Force fighter pilot with our five children, and settled in the community where the Space Center was located. But there wasn't even a grocery store. And so we were at the fringes of civilization, literally.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept and one we intend to win.
My name is Margaret Weidekamp, and I'm a curator at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. There was an understanding that the whole family is really a part of the mission, and that in that, the entire family is helping to send people to the moon. And that was something that NASA encouraged through its entire employee system.
The expectation of the public, I think, was that NASA supported us with psychological help or some sort of training, and in fact, it was minimal. There were a few speeches made about how we should support our husbands, but, you know, be good wives and cook them breakfast because they're flying, and take away all the stress at home so that they can do their job. Really, there was very little done in the way of preparation for the life that followed.
May 1962. Frank Borman, a test pilot and aeronautical engineer from Arizona, also known as No Nonsense Borman, is chosen to join the second Apollo astronaut group. NASA says Borman has the right stuff.
My name is Susan Borman, and my husband is Frank Borman, the Apollo 8 commander, the first mission to the moon in 1968. I have always felt we were the guinea pigs in the very beginning. What they sent people into our hometowns to interview school teachers and next door neighbors to give an opinion. We were literally owned by the American taxpayer, and they wanted to make sure that the American people were going to be exceptionally proud of us, so they didn't want any screwballs. And I guess if some of these interviews came back and said, boy, you better watch these people, they're, you know, they have a screw loose, then they wouldn't have been chosen. They wanted perfect families, perfect children, perfect wives. I mean, there was some pressure there.
It's a complicated sociological, psychological profile that they were looking for astronauts. And being married was seen as a sign of stability, that they were emotionally mature, that they were capable of making those kinds of commitments. It's an assignment that's highly visible. It's an assignment that requires a lot of public presence and that requires of it of the entire family, not just of the pilot. And it is one that is very much in the spotlight.
And one day he walked in the house, and I was stunned, and I said, what are you doing? And he said, call the boys in. I have something to tell you. And we sat around the kitchen table, and he said, I want you to know we are ready to go to the moon, and they have asked me to take the lead in a flight to the moon Christmas time. And I think that was the toughest thing I personally had to do, to accept it and say, Frank, are you confident in this? And he said, Susan, you know good and well I wouldn't volunteer to take this flight if I didn't have utmost confidence. And I said, okay, then I'm on board with you. And this was Apollo 8.
2 minutes, 15 seconds.
December 21st, 1968. Christmas approaches, and all eyes are looking upward for the launch of Apollo 8. the first manned lunar orbital flight.
Inboard engines have shut down.
The boys and I decided that we would go down to Cape Kennedy to watch the liftoff. It was awesome. I held my breath. I said prayers, many prayers.
Two, we have ignition. Commit liftoff. We have liftoff. This is launch control. We have cleared the tower.
Roger, tower clear.
Until you see a launch of the Saturn V, there's no way you can imagine. There's just no way. It's like watching the Empire State Building taking off.
The wives of the astronauts dispatched messages to their husbands in Apollo 8, attended church services near the Space Center in Houston, and then spent the rest of Christmas Day at home with their families. The three wives said the time of greatest tension for them had been the wait for Apollo 8 to leave lunar orbit.
I was taken to Mission Control. We were put in touch with our husbands for a couple of seconds to say Merry Christmas and maybe one other sentence. I was taken by a security car through the throngs of press, and I did have a few interviews on the front porch.
I feel very humbled at the success of all this flight. I feel very full of gratitude for the people that have worked so hard on this flight, and also for the people all over the country and even all over the world that have prayed for the success and sent all their good wishes to the crew.
You saw your husband on TV
just a few minutes ago.
Yes, that was good.
How did he look? He looked great to me.
He had a big beard.
These were women who had signed on to be military wives, and then all of a sudden they're thrust into the spotlight and really into national and international attention and expected to have opinions on political issues or to be ready for appearances at fashion shows or at charity events.
Snap of the jacket, this smart suit becomes suitable for a night on the
I am Faye Stafford, and I was married to Tom Stafford for 33 years. And he was selected on his 32nd birthday. How do you ever top that for a birthday gift?
Here she comes, ladies and gentlemen, Faye Stafford, wearing this nutmeg silk three-piece with a restrained touch of rhinestones.
They were sending us into Houston society and for these luncheons and different affairs, and our husbands were military. I don't think they accepted the idea that we were still on military pay, and couldn't keep up with that. I just didn't always like it. I always called them those casts of thousands dinners.
There is a war going on in South Vietnam. I think last week there were over 500 killings. It's a guerrilla war of increasing ferocity.
If I ever was apprehensive, I just made myself realize if we weren't there, he would be in Vietnam being shot at every day, so it was actually much, much safer than that.
When there was a flight, we would go to the other wife's house and just sit with them and be there for them, take food, take whatever was needed, or take their children and entertain them, whatever was needed at the moment.
The support of the wives was extremely important to me. We were very close and dependent upon each other. During flights, you always knew they were around and they knew exactly how you felt and what you were going through. So it was a good thing.
Well, that's about all we have for today. Each and every one of us wish each and every one of you a very Merry Christmas.
May 1969, NASA's Intergalactic Intercom, also known as the Squawk Box, is hailed by President Nixon as a truly humbling piece of technology.
Before your husband made a flight, NASA would put up what was a black box with all the transmissions in your house. And they'd put one by your bed so you could listen anytime you wanted to.
And this is where we find out exactly where we are in space, what direction, how fast we're traveling.
we could sit there, which is exactly what I did all the time, was sit by the squawk box and listen to the telecommunication between the capsule and the ground. And NASA warned us. They said, now, we're going to let you know right off the bat that if anything goes wrong, we're turning the squawk box off. And we knew that. We knew that.
As the astronauts established a voice contact again, Ken Mattingly revealed that the command service module engine had failed to make a crucial circularization, or circ burn. And this is how we heard it.
The command module did not do circ, and we're standing by.
The big burn, they used to call it, to put you back in Earth orbit. And that happened about 4 in the morning, I think. And when I went to bed, I thought, oh, they'll make it just fine. And about 3 in the morning, I couldn't stand it, so I turned the squawk box on and listened. And they did. They made it just fine. So then I could go back to sleep for a little while.
The wives of the Apollo astronauts are waiting the mission out philosophically and patiently. Mrs. Shira, whose husband has been in space twice before, put it this way. It's like having your tooth pulled, she said. You dread the first, but after that you become used to it.
And no, it never got easier. When they say it gets easier the more you experience that, that wasn't true for me. It may have been for some, but I can only speak for me. I would get through everything just fine and do very well. And then after it was all over, I would have a migraine that would send me to bed for a day. But that was how the stress affected me, and it wasn't anything long term, fortunately. And it was tough on the girls. I never realized until later, looking at pictures, that they had absolute terror on their faces. And I was always so caught up in my own emotions that I didn't really realize how hard it was for them.
I'd been a fighter pilot's wife, and I remember living in base housing and watching the Air Force black car come through, knowing that there was a minister or a priest and an officer, and you wondered where the black car would stop. And it might stop right across the street. Might stop in front of your house. But I just thought, I'll think about this later. I'll figure out how to raise 5 children if I'm a widow later. And so I just got through it. I sort of turned the off button on my emotions.
Back in Houston, the two Apollo wives said they were sure all along what the outcome would be.
Yeah, well, I've been happy the whole time.
Very good news, Mrs. Scott.
Yes, it is. Very nice.
What were your thoughts when you received the word that they'd go ahead with a normal mission?
Well, I'm just an eternal optimist. I really didn't think it would be any other way. I was delighted, though, needless to say.
Were the children anxious?
No, I don't even think they know anything about it.
Where were they?
I'm not sure. My mother took them somewhere. I think she ran them down to just down to the store for a minute, and they're not back yet.
We had a contract with Life magazine, so there was always a Life reporter and a Life photographer in the house, too, photographing everything, and often that was pretty hard.
NASA logbook entry, September 1969. Life magazine releases exclusive interviews at home with astronaut wives Susan Borman and Faye Stafford. I always say my job is to keep his hat size the same, comments Faye Stafford.
The contract with Life magazine was put into place as a way for NASA to publicize its program, to let people get to know who the astronauts were, and it was arranged that it would be not only profiles of the astronauts, but also profiles of the families. And so that was a part of their experience that became completely different and really unique to being married to an astronaut.
During the flight, they literally lived in the home. There was one woman that literally moved in. There could be 100 of them right on your front lawn. And we did. We called it the Death Watch.
I, for one, was much more shy, so I didn't enjoy meeting with the press at all. I did, but it was always hard for me. Always.
For some of the women, it was very easy. For others, it was very painful. There were some of the girls were extremely shy. I'm not shy, so it wasn't that difficult for me.
There was a huge TV tower out in my yard. I remember one day looking out and seeing Barbara Walters walking down the street and all of the different reporters. Walter Cronkite, of course, was he was usually in Houston.
At Mission Control in Houston, it's, of course, a tense time for the Apollo team there and the astronauts' families as well. And Bill Plant reports on the situation.
Steps up to the hatch on the starboard side of the helicopter.
Invariably, a reporter would ask, "How do you feel?" And you felt differently at any given moment, and it was hard to answer. So sort of the standard answer was proud, thrilled, and happy. And it was kind of a joke among us that you weren't really supposed to feel anything else. It would have been not too good if you'd have gotten up and said, "I want him home right now."
The astronauts' wives marked the safe return of their husbands with a prayer of thanksgiving, a sip of champagne, and an appropriate comment from each. Mrs. Susan Borman said, "It's great for the world."
There are so many thousands of people that gave their lives to make this possible, and I think the free people of the world are going to benefit by this with stories that will be told for a long, long time.
Oh, heavens, oh, tremendous privileges. After the Gemini mission, we toured the entire far eastern part of the world, and then after Apollo 8, it was Europe, all of Europe.
And the trips to the White House were just, never dreamed of going to the White House. I guess it was after Apollo Soyuz that President Ford pinned Tom's second star on him. And we were on the Truman balcony at the White House overlooking the mall. It was really something. I cherish those memories a lot.
The three astronauts who are pioneering this Apollo flight are as different as men can possibly be. Wally Schirra, 45, the commander, a Renaissance man interested in all things. And Walt Cunningham, 36. Cunningham is a fearless iconoclast who will tell off...
It turns out they were all only children, or they were first sons with a great deal of distance between the next sibling. They were all driven to be the best. They were all alpha personalities.
Three unusual men, blazing the way for a unique era.
He worked 16 hours a day most days. It was extremely intense. And there wasn't a lot of time to just sort of sit back and enjoy life. And so I was always ready with the children all healthy and clean and the house all clean and ready to go in the boat to water ski on the one day a week he was home, or maybe a day and a half. I thought that was normal.
If I ever needed a little painting done in the house, that was like asking him for to bring me the moon. I would have liked to have had a career because it was lonely. I accepted that as just part of the package, that the space program would be first. And I was lucky if I could be second.
April 1972. Apollo astronaut Charlie Duke has distinguished himself with his duty, his integrity, and his drive to excel. Now he could become the 10th man to walk on the moon.
My name is Dottie Duke, and I'm married to Charlie Duke, who flew on Apollo 16, one of the flights to the moon. I could tell very much that the space program, his work, was foremost in his life, and that I was kind of just there, again, when I was needed and called upon. I think there were some husbands that maybe could have shown the priority of their family more so than Charlie did, and he didn't do that. And as a wife, too, you felt like you couldn't complain because you wanted to be a part of it and support it and felt like, well, that was your wifely duty to support it. But inside, I was suffering quite a bit.
Being an astronaut is a high-stress job, and it's one that requires incredible ambition, talent, dedication, but it also is one that in some ways rewarded going to extremes, being willing to take extraordinary risks, strap oneself on the top of what's essentially a ballistic missile and be willing to be shot into space, in the case of the lunar missions, a 250,000 miles, further than any human being has gone. For some of them, that resulted in a profound humility and a sense of how delicate life is on this fragile little planet that they saw behind them. And for others, it really, I think, ultimately, that was a lifestyle that had a high toll. Some of the risk-taking behavior that is an essential part of being able to make that leap has side effects in their life where they took other risks in terms of extramarital relationships or alcohol. There was all of the famous fast driving of Corvettes. These were people who were used to some risk-taking.
Two of the people with the largest personal stake in this unfolding drama are within a mile or two of the manned spacecraft center here at Houston. Dottie Duke, wife of the lunar module pilot. Mrs. Duke has had...
Well, the day before he went, we went to this special viewing area to see him, and he was behind glass in quarantine, but we had a microphone and we could talk to each other. We couldn't touch each other, but we could talk to each other that day.
Both women are described as calm and as described as understanding that their husbands are in no danger.
He took some things with him, and one of them was a picture that we had had a friend take for us, and we all signed, the children and I all signed it in the back, and Charlie wrote, this is from astronaut Charlie Duke. And so the last thing he did before he walked back up into the hatch to lift off from the moon was to drop this picture on the surface of the moon, and he took a picture of it. It's been in many photograph albums of space pictures and things like that because it's an unusual picture of the picture of the picture of the family that was left on the moon.
The Apollo 16 astronauts came around the moon this afternoon with John Young and Charles Duke preparing to power their landing ship down to the surface. Mission Control has promised a decision when voice contact is regained. And if it comes on time, we'll be back within this broadcast to report it. This is Walter Cronkite at the CBS News Space Headquarters in New York.
When he came home from the flight, I thought, oh, now things will be different. He's been so focused on the flight. Now it's over, and now we can focus on our marriage. And I talked to him about that, and they immediately put him into working on the shuttle, and he still was this whole workaholic, consumed person. And at that point, I realized he wasn't going to change. He was never going to be the husband, the caring, the loving, you know, husband that I really wanted. And I came to the conclusion after all of that that, well, maybe there's no purpose in life. Maybe we just live and we die and we struggle and it's lonely and it's sad. And so why should I live any longer? And so even though I had two healthy sons and I had this husband who was famous, I became suicidal. I've seriously considered killing myself because I saw no purpose in life, that why should I live any longer?
I think the pressures of the job, the idea that the men were always at the Cape, the notoriety, it just was difficult for some families to handle. There were many women that paid attention to them. It's true.
Well, it was pretty annoying if you went out and I was amazed at how some women, it didn't bother them. They would still just come up. One evening we were out for dinner, and this woman came up and kissed Tom on the top of the head, said, I've always wanted to kiss a bald head. They just wanted to touch an astronaut, or it was pretty sickening at times. That was the reason for some of the divorces, though, and you always had to live with that, too. Like, well, am I going to be next?
When I was so depressed with Charlie, I remember I brought up divorce to him, and this was after his mission, and I brought it up and told him how lonely I was and the thought of divorcing him. And he didn't really say much about it. And I even called a lawyer just to find out, you know, to investigate how you go about it and stuff like that. But I started thinking, and I think God had me think this way, that, you know, Charlie can't love me the way I want to be loved. Maybe there isn't anybody out there that can love me the way I want to be loved. And so divorcing him would break up our family. And so maybe that's not such a good idea. I should just stick it through because what do I know? You know, maybe I'll never find somebody.
There was a perception among the astronaut corps that that image of the astronaut as family man, as good husband, had become so important to the public image of being an astronaut that it was in fact essential to continuing to be an astronaut. And so we know now that there were several marriages, a number of marriages, that were staying together merely in order to kind of keep up the appearance. And the first astronaut divorced rocked the program, but at the same time, there were a number of other astronauts who were really watching that to see what the reaction would be. And when it didn't end the program, then there was a whole series of other divorces that followed on after that as people decided to move on with their lives.
January 1970. The astronaut office is sad to announce that astronaut Don Azzelli and his wife Harriet Azzelli are to separate. This will be a first for the space program.
We called it the First Wives Club because so many of them have remarried. It's interesting to me that the women have stayed close, probably closer than the men have.
As I look back over my life, I don't know how it would have been different. And in my heart, really, even though it was very depressing, so much that I was suicidal, I feel like that I've got a purpose now to share that and to help people in their marriages all over the world. And so I wouldn't change anything.
I think it is a special bond that we maintain with the women that still get together. They were the original wives that were together many, many years ago. And most of those women are either widows or they're divorced. And we do try to maintain that contact because it becomes more important as you get older. And you remember what a special time that was in history, and just having those kind of friends back then in a business that was one where you needed friends for support.
I'm not sure it ever came back to a normal family life. What could he ever do to top those experiences? I know I longed for a normal family life again. But Tom always craved that excitement and that applause, and he was happiest on a stage. You know, Betty Davis said applause is addictive, and I know that's true now.